Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Weird House Cinema. This is Rob Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today we're going to be talking about the 1940 size-related thriller, Dr. Cyclops. You know that line, that classic Hollywood line about how I stayed big, it's the pictures that got small? Well, you can't say that about this movie, because this movie is really truly about actors getting small.
That's right. This is our first 1940s film. I mean, barely, since it's a 1940 release. This is one I was not familiar with. I'd never heard of it, despite the fact that it has a pretty famous director who we'll get into more about in a second. But it's Ernest B. Schoedsack, who, if that name doesn't ring a bell, I think his most famous film will for you. It was, of course, King Kong.
Yeah, this movie I thought was a real firecracker. Like, it looks great. It has amazing special effects. The story isn't as complex as you might hope. But then again, I mean, this was a horror thriller of the 1930s and 40s of the Hays Code era. So you can only expect so much moral and intellectual complexity. But just as a big special effects thriller, the kind of Transformers or Independence Day of 1940. Mm-hmm. It's fantastic.
Yeah, and I think that's also the way you have to approach it. It is a 1940 special effects fiasco, and the special effects very much come first. And you know, by today's standards, they might not look as amazing, but that's again only if you're looking at it as a modern viewer and not thinking about the history of filmmaking. Because I think if you sit there and watch the film in its entirety and keep reminding yourself, like, this is 1940, this is what had been done before with similar effects, and it will impress you.
Oh, I think the special effects in this movie do look fantastic. I mean, I think they look so much better than the, quote, realistic CGI that floods the films of today.
Well, that's true, yeah. I mean, it's very polished. You know, using the tools of the day, it creates, I think, some high-quality visuals.
So this is, we've talked about a number of mad scientist movies, and I'm sure we will talk about many more mad scientist movies in the future. Mad scientists are kind of the hub of the wheel of Weird House cinema. And this particular mad scientist is a mad scientist who likes to shrink people with radiation.
Yes, the villainous Dr. Thorkel. And yeah, he's pretty great because he's, you know, I guess his real defining characteristic is he's a complete megalomaniac, you know?
Yes.
He already feels himself to be a giant among tiny people. And his super science just enables him to make that, an objective reality.
Now, I think Dr. Thorkell would probably shrink you to death for the way you pronounced his name, because of one of the funny things in this movie. So his name is spelled T-H-O-R-K-E-L. So I read that, and like any other normal American English speaker, I would think Thorkell.
Yeah, if I had to go to an appointment with Dr. Thorkell, I would call and be like, yeah, I'm a patient of Dr. Thorkel's.
But the characters in this movie make a really special effort to always emphasize the second letter. So it's like Sardo, no mister, accent on the dough. Here we get Thorkell, no mister. It's doctor, accent on the kell.
Dr. Thorkell. Yeah, and in this picture, you can basically... Well, here's the elevator pitch. A mad scientist working in the South American jungle miniaturizes his colleagues when he feels his megalomania is threatened. So it's basically, it's Apocalypse Now, but with Dr. Thorkell instead of Colonel Kurtz, science instead of war, and miniaturization instead of the horror.
I'd say that's about accurate. Yeah. And instead of Martin Sheen, it's a ragtag team of the world's greatest scientists and a mule guy.
Yeah. And instead of spending like a large portion of the film about the journey, that journey is really quick in this one. They just skip you right through it.
Should we hit that trailer audio?
Yeah, let's hear it.
To them, a crocodile becomes as huge as a prehistoric monster. A rifle as unwieldy as a siege gun. A terrifying black cat whose jaws mean death. A dog looms larger than an elephant. Death in the hands of a ruthless monster.
All right, so let's talk about the people involved here. Really, the one we're going to spend the most time on is, of course, the director, Ernest B. Schoedsack.
I know almost nothing about the life of Schoedsack except that he is involved with one of the great early special effects and, I don't know what you might call it, science fiction horror films of the big studio era, which is King Kong.
Yeah, I mean, really, King Kong, it despite being very much a genre film, it transcends genre. Like it is that film is an icon of cinematic history itself. You know, it's kind of difficult to overstate its importance in the history of film. But he and certainly I think Mystery Science Theater 3000 fans would agree, it is a great ape movie. But Schoedsack also directed another great ape movie, and that would be Mighty Joe Young. So if you're not familiar with King Kong for reasons unimaginable, then perhaps you've heard of Mighty Joe Young.
Did that get some kind of remake in the 1990s?
Yes, it did. Goodness, I forget who was in it, but they had Mighty Joe Young is an enlarged ape as well, but not nearly as enlarged as King Kong.
It's a medium enlarged ape.
Yeah, and I think I've seen some comparisons just in the same way that Godzilla keeps getting bigger and bigger in films. King Kong also inevitably just gets bigger and bigger, but Mighty Joe Young was always a smaller giant ape.
So some of this guy's big movies seem all focused on changes in size perspective, either really big creatures or really little creatures, smaller than they're supposed to be. And this is funny because I think there were – this is sort of the A-list version of that kind of director. But there were also B-list versions of that kind of director, because you get people like Burt I. Gordon, who made – B movies, almost all of which are about creatures of unusual size, either like a person or a creature that gets shrunken down, or creatures that get blown up real big.
Yeah. And, I think ultimately Burt I. Gordon was able to make some really interesting films, but they're generally not put on the same pedestal as King Kong.
None of them look as beautiful as Dr. Cyclops does. Another thing that Dr. Cyclops really has going for it, with the modern release especially, or at least the Blu-ray of it that we watched, the it has three color Technicolor, and the Technicolor is gorgeous. Mm-hmm. The colors are just dripping off the screen.
Yeah, in a similar way to Dr. X, though that was not Technicolor. That was, what, two-tone Technicolor?
Two-color Technicolor, yeah. This is three colors. So this is like the color, you know, color films that would come later.
Yeah, so there's a certain unreality to it, but it's beautiful. And it's certainly, I mean, I find it more engaging than a lot of black and white films of the period. I guess it depends. Like, you wouldn't want to see Mad Love in color. Mad Love belongs in black and white. Like, that is the world of that film. But this one really benefits from the color.
Well, and taking place in the jungle, I feel like there are a lot of shots in it that I wonder if they were only included to take advantage of that beautiful three-color Technicolor. Like, like there are parts where it will just cut away to some kind of tropical bird that is squawking in a tree. And, you know, we see all of its beautiful feathers.
Yeah. Sort of, you know, before 3D, there was Technicolor.
Yeah.
Again, it's quite a beautiful looking film. So let's talk about the director behind it. Again, Ernest B. Schoedsack, who lived 1893 through 1979. We're not going to really be able to touch on his entire biography here, but if you want a good one, you can go to the usual places. I found Britannica had a nice one online, but here are some of the interesting points, sort of the bullet points of his life that I think are worth driving home here. So, first of all, he ran away from home as a teenager and worked as a surveyor in San Francisco. He got a job as a cameraman with help from his brother in 1914. And then during the First World War, he served as a cameraman in the Signal Corps in France. He stayed in Europe. After that, he got involved in adventure filmmaking. So this is interesting because it makes sense given the nature of films like King Kong, but it also, it seems to run, against the grain if you think about his success in fiction, because earlier on it's less purely fictional. There's a certain documentary aspect to it, like fictionalized documentary work. So he served with the Red Cross in 1919, helped refugees from the Russo-Polish War, and he also filmed this conflict, as well as the Greco-Turkish War of 1921 through 22. And in this, he essentially wound up working as a conflict journalist and was then sponsored by the New York Times as a cameraman on an around-the-world expedition.
Wow.
So he worked with a pilot by the name of Marion C. Cooper, and they began producing what they called natural dramas, which were a kind of combination of travelogue and drama. This is super fascinating, given what we've covered on Stuff to Blow Your Mind before. In 1925, he joined William Beebe's expedition to the Galapagos Islands as a cameraman.
Ah, now William Beebe was, if you'll recall, was he a marine biologist? He was a researcher who got down into basically a gigantic metal ball that just was dangled down deep into the ocean to see what kind of life could be observed through a tiny window in this ball at depths that had never before been documented firsthand.
Yeah, the bathysphere.
Horrifying, because this ball had no means of self-propulsion. It was not a submersible. It was not a submarine. It was just a hollow metal sphere and dangling by a chain. So if the chain breaks, you just sink to the bottom of the ocean.
Yes. But he was, as we discussed in past episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, he was also notable because he tended to surround himself not only with technicians on these expeditions, but also artists, like people who could write about it, people who could illustrate what was going on. And it turns out Schoedsack was one of the creatives that he brought aboard to document the work, at least on one of the expeditions.
Now, I think the bathysphere observations were not in the Galapagos. That was somewhere in the Atlantic. It was off, Bermuda or somewhere in the Bahamas?
Yeah, I believe so. This would have been a different journey. But still, it's wonderful how these two came together. I wasn't expecting him to come up in this. So anyway, from here, Schoedsack and Cooper, they go on to produce a natural drama titled Chang, a drama of the wilderness from 1927. This earned a nomination for Best Picture at the very first Academy Awards. He then directed The Four Feathers in 1929, based on the 1902 novel shot in California and the Sudan. And then he shot Rango in Sumatra, which is a film about, and this just sounds like super ambitious for any filmmaker, because it's about a boy, an orangutan, and a tiger, filmed in 31 again. Then he shot The Most Dangerous Game in 32.
Oh, okay. Wait, we Didn't we just talk about? No, we talked about Ernest Dickerson's Surviving the Game.
Surviving the Game. Yep,
the Ice-T movie, which is sort of a based on the similar concept, the novella or novel, The Most Dangerous Game, which is about a human who hunts men.
Yes. And so it's been popular for a while. It's one of those stories that's going to keep getting adapted in one form or the other. Now, from here, Shotek and Cooper moved on to what would be their most famous motion picture that they worked on, and that was King Kong of 1933. And then they followed this up with The Son of Kong, which also came out in 1933. And then they did they also did a movie titled Blind Adventure, which also came out in 1933. So it was quite a year for these two.
Regular Roger Corman over here. This is like Roger Corman's 1957 or whatever year it was that he made like 14 movies.
Yeah. An impressive year. They were really just firing on all cylinders. Now, in 1935, they made a film titled The Last Days of Pompeii. And this was ultimately, at least commercially, a failed attempt at an historical epic. So after this, they were kind of, I guess, in some version of director's jail. Yeah, he ended up doing smaller pictures. But then he got another shot at a big genre film, a special effects feature, and that is 1940's Dr. Cyclops. And Cooper was an uncredited producer on this film. Now, of course, we'll get back to Dr. Cyclops in depth here, but World War II broke out, and Shodzak was like a lot of people, sucked into the war machine anew. And while testing photographic equipment at high altitude for the U.S. Army Air Corps, he suffered a severe eye injury. I was trying to get a firm account of it. If there's a good biography about Shodzak, I wasn't able to find one, like a book length biography. I believe what happened is he accidentally dropped his face mask, and I'm a little foggy on the exact nature of what the injury was, if we're talking about some sort of a light blast based injury or if it's pressure based. But the end result was severely damaged his eyesight, and he only directed a couple of additional films, really only one notable film after that, and this was Mighty Joe Young in 1949, which featured Oscar-winning special effects by O'Brien and Ray Harryhausen.
Oh, and, God.
Yeah, so another big name. And then he finally directed a portion of This Is Cinerama in 1952, uncredited, to promote the Cinerama widescreen projection process. But that was pretty much it. Like, after this eye injury, he just wasn't able or didn't want to direct. I think it was more about ability. And then he died in 1979. Cooper died in 1973. He did a bit more work after Mighty Joe Young came out, including serving as executive producer on 1956's The Searchers, directed by John Ford and starring, of course, John Wayne.
This is a fantastic coincidence how this story about his damaged eyesight connects to the plot of Dr. Cyclops. It almost makes me wonder, do you know what exactly the time of his injury was? Could it have been before Dr. Cyclops, or was it after?
I believe that's the weird thing about this. I've not been able to find a firm date for this injury, like a statement, in this year or in this month, this is when Shodzak suffered the eye injury. But it's my understanding that the eye injury occurred after Dr. Cyclops.
Wow. So we'll get into this a little bit more when we discuss the plot, but one of the main situation points of Dr. Cyclops is that the titular doctor, the Dr. Thorkell, is a brilliant scientist, but he's limited by damage to his eyes.
Yeah.
He's got poor eyesight already and relies on these really thick glasses.
Yeah, so this is just mysterious to me. Like, it's either an amazing coincidence, or I have it wrong, and there is more connective tissue here. Like, maybe he had, previously damaged his eyes in some fashion, or his eyesight was already fading. I'm not sure, what the answer is here. Mm-hmm. But as it turns out, like, his actual biography and some of the plot elements in Dr. Cyclops do line up.
Now, he did not write Dr. Cyclops, though.
Correct, right. Dr. Cyclops was written by a writer by the name of Tom Kilpatrick, who lived 1898 through 1962. And you can look him up on IMDb, but basically he wrote various crime and Western screenplays and teleplays, but nothing that really jumped out to me personally.
I mean, the script here is not really anything to write home about, except in the skillful way that it efficiently strings together excellent special effects set pieces. But you're not going to like run into interesting character development or like super witty dialogue in this movie. This is a very much a sets and special effects driven film. But I will give the script credit for connecting each one of those things to the next in a very fast paced and enjoyable way.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about Dr. Thorkell. In this film, he is played by an actor by the name of Albert Dekker, who lived 1905 through 1968. He was a Broadway star turned film actor. And later in his life, he served on the California state legislature and largely transitioned back to stage in his later career. He often played aggressive characters, and this is probably due to his great size. So he was 6'2", which granted isn't like super tall, but it's reasonably tall. I'm 6'2" or so, and I bump my head way too often.
He seems big in this movie.
Yeah, and I think part of that too is that not only is he 6'2", but he's got kind of a thick physique, like not obese or anything, but like he looks kind of beefy, especially for a mad scientist in a movie. Usually they're a bit scrawnier, and like Dr. Thorkell looks like he could really throw down.
You would not want to tangle with Thorkell.
Right. This guy, Albert Dekker, played him. Notable roles for him include roles in Kiss Me Deadly and East of Eden, which was 55, I believe, as well as his last film role, which was in 1969's The Wild Bunch.
The hyper-violent Sam Peckinpah movie, in which I think he plays some kind of like railroad policeman or like a railway detective.
Mm.
He's hunting the outlaws in the movie, if I recall.
That's one that I have somehow I managed to get through my 20s and 30s without seeing The Wild Bunch.
It is a dusty, dirty, nasty, violent movie. It makes you need a bath. In fact, I would say the full vibe of that movie is summed up in one exchange. The outlaws arrive at the compound of this powerful guy, and the guy says to them, like, "You're filthy, you need baths." And one of the outlaws says, "We don't want baths, we want women."
It sounds delightful.
That is one sentence that communicates a lot.
All right, well, in this film, like we've said, he's delightful. He's got this wonderful, imposing physical presence. He's got these these scheming eyes that are accentuated by his glasses, bald head, an evil mustache. And I have to say, he was reminding me of somebody as I was watching this, and I figured out who it is. It's British actor Julian Barrett, who Mighty Boosh fans out there, you might recognize him as the actor who played Howard Moon. But he also showed up on Dark Place with Garth Marenghi as a priest.
Okay.
And he also was in something recently. He was the titular character in Mindhorn, which I've heard good things about.
I never caught him in Dark Place, but I should go back and watch that whole series again. It in one sitting.
It's ironically, it is the ape heavy episode, I believe.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Howard Moon or Julian Barrett, same height as Albert Dekker, and I feel like Dr. Thorkell could have easily been a Julian Barrett character. I included photos here if you can compare the two. Like they have very similar physicality, facial features. Both are prone to wearing a mustache, so I include that for what it's worth.
Yes, I can see. And like Dr. Thorkell, he's going to hurt you real bad.
All right. So there are other humans in this film, and we'll touch on them in less detail, because there's not much else for non-Dr. Thorkell characters to do in this film.
I mean, I would say they execute their functions correctly, which is to move the plot from one fantastic set and prop sort of extravaganza to another.
Yes, and do so with a serious look on their face.
Yeah.
So the first one to mention here is Thomas Coley, who plays Bill Stockton. He lived 1913 through 1989. This was his very first film role, followed by mostly a lot of TV work. His partner was actor and writer William Rorick. And Rorick was a theater actor on Broadway who was also in Not of This Earth.
Oh, wow. So that was the 1957 Roger Corman movie that we have covered on a previous episode of Weird House Cinema. It was, I believe, the B-side to Attack of the Crab Monsters. So if in 57 you went out to a drive-in theater to watch a sci-fi double feature, you may well have seen Attack of the Crab Monsters and then Not of This Earth with this guy. What was his name again? William Rorick.
Yeah, William Rorick.
He was the doctor in the movie. I think, not to be mean, I think we did not draw a lot of attention to his performance in the movie because there's not much to say about it, except his character, if you recall, he played Dr. Rochelle, who was the blood clinic doctor who gets hypnotized by the alien so that he's unable to talk about the alien's blood condition. Mm-hmm. So other characters would, you know, they'd be sitting at a table in a restaurant and the other characters would be like, don't you think it's strange that that man had alien blood? And Dr. Rochelle would be like, oh, you guys want to get some appetizers?
Yeah. So it wasn't the most memorable of roles, but Rorick was in a number of interesting films, several of which I've seen. He was in God Told Me To. This was the Larry Cohen film about alien messiahs. He was in Day of the Dolphin. He was in The Wasp Woman. And he was a friend. This is interesting. Biographically, he was a friend of author E.M. Forrester. And Coley and Rorick, apparently, they would entertain him when he was in town, that sort of thing. They'd go out and see shows and stuff. But that's the connect. They're all connected here to Coley. Coley is the one in this film, not Rorick. And but the two of them apparently collaborated on various projects over the course of their careers and lives together.
Coley plays the sort of lead love interest in the movie. He's the only character who's hunky enough to potentially end up falling in love with the one female character. So you kind of know what's going to happen.
Yeah, it's a very G-golly role. And again, this was his first screen role to boot. So the results are very wooden. There's just not much to this part here. But that still seems like he had an interesting life and career. All right, let's talk about the sole female character in this film. The character is Dr. Mary Robinson. The actor is Janice Logan. She was born in 1915, died in 1965. She only appeared in six films, and this was her third. But here's again a nice connection to the previous episode of Weird House Cinema. Her last two film roles were both Mexican films directed by Rene Cardona.
The director of Santo and the Treasure of Dracula.
Exactly, yes. A major name in Mexican cinema. So both of these films were from 1944. One, the translated name is The Black Ace, and the other is Summer Hotel. And I was looking this up. The Black Ace also featured a Dutch occultist and magician named David Tobias Bamberg, who billed himself as Fu Manchu. And Bamberg also co-wrote it. But which I don't know. It sounds like he was sort of an occult star or would-be star of the day. And so he wound up in Mexico City and was like, hey, let's do a movie.
Hmm.
Anyway, Logan is also rather wooden in this role, but it's not like the film gives her much to do other than scurry around and try not to be grabbed by giant hands or eaten by giant cats. Then we have the character of Dr. Bullfinch, played by Charles Halton, who lived 1876 through 1959, actor of stage and film. I would say he has a little more to do in this. He's actually pretty funny because he's this stuck-up professor through and through, even after he's been reduced to a tiny human wearing a handkerchief toga.
Yeah, he refuses a lot of things in the movie. Like, he's constantly being told to do things and saying, like, I refuse.
Yes, on scientific grounds, Dr. Thorkell, I absolutely, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Let's see. Then we have the character of Steve Baker, played by Victor Killian, who lived 1891 through 1979. He was in films like Only Angels Have Wings and The Oxbow Incident. He wound up blacklisted from Hollywood, presumably for political beliefs, but ended up doing a lot of TV and stage work instead after that. And I mean, he's all right in this. He's also it's a very typical type of performance and role for this time period.
He's the mule guy. He's all about the mules.
Yeah. All right. Next, we have an actor by the name of Frank Iaconelli, who plays the character Pedro. This guy lived 1898 through 1965. He was an Italian-born World War I vet who became a naturalized U.S. citizen. And he was a vaudeville performer, later a USO tour manager. He played a lot of Italian characters, as one might admit, but he also expect rather, but he also seemed to have a lot of roles in films playing stereotypical Mexican characters.
Oh,
and
no.
In this film, he plays Pedro, which is very much a goofy stereotype character.
Yeah, they don't say what nationality Pedro is supposed to be, but he is playing a Latin American character, Pedro, who at least definitely in the first half of the movie is the butt of some jokes.
Yeah.
About like trying to find his lost horse, which has actually been shrunken with a shrink ray.
Yeah. So, you know, this was a casting situation that definitely made me sigh a bit. If you want to know more about Iaconelli, I did find a page on bwesterns.com, b-westerns.com, that has seems to be the only place I could find online. Like, you can only find much of a biography of him on IMDb, but this site gets a little more into what kind of vaudeville acts he was involved in. And he did seem to kind of make a career in places out of playing a Mexican stereotype. And certainly that's what more or less he's doing in this film. Now, another interesting character that is involved in this film, ultimately uncredited, but there's a guy by the name of Charles Gamora, who lived 1903 through 1961, and he's an uncredited makeup artist on this film. Were you familiar with this guy before, Joe?
Well, I guess by his work, but not by name.
Okay, so he was born in the Philippines. He was a Hollywood makeup artist who became known as the King of the Gorilla Men. and it's interesting how this came to be. Like, apparently he's a guy who would hang around outside the studio, and he would offer to paint for you or draw for you. Like, he had sort of an innate, and I'm guessing kind of like self-taught artistic ability. And of course, people eventually notice this, and they're like, "Oh, bring this guy in. We got some stuff to paint. Let's get him going." And I guess he was up for anything. And at one point, in one of these films, they busted out a gorilla suit, and he's like, "Hey, that should be me. I'm the right, just the right height. I've got the physicality to carry this heavy suit. Let me get in there." And so that's what he did. And aside to doing he did a lot of monster makeup in other films, but he has 60 makeup credits on IMDb, but he also has 60 acting credits, most of which are playing gorillas, wearing gorilla costumes. And I do recommend looking him up, because it's kind of amazing. Like, if there was a gorilla costume in a film, this was often the guy that was wearing it. In addition to some, you know, aliens here and there, he definitely did some alien costumes and other kind of like humanoid monster costumes. But his specialty was the gorilla costume.
Oh, and I see. What do you know? He's in at least one adaptation of The Murders in the Rue Morgue.
Yeah. In addition to being an actor and an artist, he was also an inventor, and he held a couple of patents, including I would look these up on Google Scholar, a sanitary pad holder and a tissue dispenser.
Wow.
Yeah. So interesting fella. Now, again, he was just a makeup guy in this. The two main special effects names were Farcio Edwart and Gordon Jennings. These were the two that were nominated for an Oscar for the special effects in this film for the 13th Academy Awards. Now, they ultimately lost to The Thief of Baghdad, but these are some impressive special effects, like we said. They're impressive for their time. It's not the first time that we see miniaturized humans or giant animals in a film. Certainly Todd Browning's 1936 film, The Devil Doll, predates it. But this film makes some impressive use of supersized sets, giant hands, creative combinations of footage.
Yeah, the special effects in this film are really top-notch. I was trying to think of earlier examples of really good-looking special effects for miniaturized humans, and I recalled the main example I could think of are the excellent shrunken human effects in Bride of Frankenstein. By James Whale, which was released in 1935. Now, you might remember in that movie when we first meet, you could argue, the villain of the film, Dr. Mm-hmm. Septimus Pretorius, also just one of my favorite mad scientists in movies. Dr. Thorkell and Dr. Septimus Pretorius, they're really up there in the canons of mad science in the first few decades of studio motion pictures.
Love Dr. Pretorius in the Frankenstein film, Bride of Frankenstein, he's such a mad science enabler, you know?
Yes.
Frankenstein is like, "Oh, I can't do it anymore. I'm emotionally wrought from that last film." And he's like, no, we've got to get you back in there. We've got to get you back in there. You can do it. Let's do some evil.
There's also a great part in Bride of Frankenstein where we see Dr. Pretorius just going down into a crypt just to have like a midnight snack. Like he goes down into a crypt at night for a picnic. He lays out a spread with like food and wine and stuff on a big tombstone. It's wonderful.
Oh man. I forgot about that part, but yeah.
But I think it's like right when we first meet Dr. Pretorius in the movie. I think, what is it? Who is it who's playing Dr. Frankenstein in the movie? Is it Colin Clive?
Yes, it's right? Colin Clive.
Yeah, so he's meeting with Colin Clive, and he's like showing off his latest work, which are these jars of homemade homunculi. So he's got like tiny humans in jars, and I think he has like a tiny king in one glass vial and a tiny queen in another. I don't really recall the special effect relating to the plot much. Maybe I'm forgetting how it connects, but it doesn't really.
It's just like, look at what I can do.
Yeah.
I'm pretty great. You're great. Let's work together and you will do great mad science-y things.
Well, yeah, it seems like one of those things that I suspect often happened in early special effects driven movies like this, which is that somebody had figured out how to do a certain kind of effect in a way that looked good. So you just find a way to work it into the movie. It's like, well, we can do it. Why not do it? So let's get a homunculus in this movie.
Yeah.
And I didn't look deep into it, but as a side note, I think those homunculus effects in Bride of Frankenstein were done by John Fulton and David Horsley. And that was by, it was done by like combining different shots. So you'd have a shot of people inside full size glass jars with a certain kind of background. And then that was matted over the full shot, you know, at normal distance with the actors looking huge in comparison.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
All right, well, let's get into the plot of Dr. Cyclops.
Okay, here's the full plot breakdown. You know, we always have to comment on the opening credits, and this movie also has excellent opening credits, like a lot of the weird older movies we have watched. I feel like opening credits used to be really cool for weird sci-fi movies, and then they got kind of whatever, you know, it'd just be some like words on a starfield background for a few decades, and then they just started doing away with opening credits altogether.
Yeah, but for a while, certainly in this age, it feels like the opening credits were treated like the poster, you know, as if you might be walking by the projection screen and deciding whether you're going to stop and finish watching. I mean, that's the ultimate weird. I guess you're getting the audience revved up, but it's like they've already paid their money. They're already in the seat. They're clearly not going to walk out yet. But I guess it's about just preparing them for what's to come.
Well, there's actually a kind of visual continuity from the opening credits to the opening scene in this movie, because you've got while the credits are rolling, there is this flickering light effect that creates a kind of auroral unease that is then replicated again once you get to the opening scene. It's like the same shimmering, flickering light effect carries over into the scene of a bald man in welding goggles who is leaning over a table examining a fluorescent green tube in a room lit by the shimmering green light. And of course, this is Dr. Thorkell. Mm. And the movie gets right to it because his colleague Mendoza enters the room. And of course, my brain, every time somebody said Mendoza, my brain kept going to The Simpsons. his colleague Mendoza enters the room and he says to Dr. Thorkell, "How much longer will you struggle before you realize you can't do it?" And Thorkell says, "No longer, my dear Mendoza, because I have done it. Look for yourself." So they examine what it is that Thorkell has been looking at, and Mendoza is aghast. He is shaken. Thorkell says, "There should be sufficient radium to tear it to shreds, and yet it's still alive." And we don't know what they're talking about, but Mendoza is horrified. He's terrified of the power of whatever they've discovered. And he starts saying, like, "You must destroy your slides. You must burn your notes." And then we get some classic backstory through utterly implausible dialogue. You know, when somebody says something to another character that person would have no occasion to say to them, just obviously for the benefit of the audience. So Mendoza says, "When I discovered this gigantic radium deposit, I first thought of you, Dr. Thorkell, my teacher, of Dr. Thorkell, the great biologist. I sent for you to counsel me. I began to imagine here in the jungle, the Thorkell Institute, a palace of healing to which all might come." And it was very much like, "Grandpa Seth has been dead for 3 weeks now, and it's been hard on all of us, including me, his daughter."
That is correct, Joe, my podcast partner, who has podcasted with me for many years at this point.
But Thorkell is immediately dismissive of Mendoza's concerns. He's like, we now have the very cosmic force of creation itself. We can shape life like clay. And then Mendoza, again, with the classic sci-fi movie line, he says, "You are tampering with powers reserved to God," which is almost verbatim the last line of Bride of the Monster by Ed Wood. You remember that part?
Yeah, I think so.
The movie with Bela Lugosi and Tor Johnson, and at the end of the movie, Bela's mansion explodes. I don't remember why. Like, there's a giant octopus attack, and the mansion explodes. And then a guy just kind of soberly looks at the camera and says, "He tampered in God's domain."
So Mendoza's like, "We shouldn't tamper in God's domain." But Dr. Thorkell is like, "Yeah, that's what we're doing, and we're going to do it."
He literally says, you're tampering with powers reserved to God. And Thorkell says, "That is good. That is just what I am doing." And so Mendoza tries to forbid it, but Thorkell, he's tasted the god power now, and there's no going back. So it is time to murder. And the Mendoza murder is a very cool scene, I thought. Thorkell shoves Mendoza's head through this radioactive green tube he's been looking at. And then there's a photographic effect where Mendoza's face is just gradually layered over by skull paint. I liked it.
It's a weird scene. Apparently, this one was removed from some TV airings of the film. So I don't know if they found it, like, maybe it was for time, or it was just, like, considered too graphic. There is a severity to it. Like, it firmly establishes Dr. Thorkell as a guy who will murder for his science, and will really not think twice about it. It's not like there was a struggle or some sort of accident. It wasn't one of those situations where, oh, I've stumbled into murder and now this is who I am. He's like, got to kill you now, and he does it.
Right. So next we cut to some guys in a fancy study, and it's a room that sort of reminds me of M's office in the Sean Connery James Bond movies. Mm-hmm. But weirdly, despite what you might assume about the sort of pipe tobacco drabness of such an environment, the first thing I couldn't ignore was how much the colors drip just in this scene in a study, because the opening scene is very much shimmering green and black. It's actually sort of closer to the look of the two-color Technicolor range in Dr. X, which we watched for a previous episode. Remember how that whole movie was had a kind of diseased green and orange palette without the full range of full-color Technicolor. This has all the colors now that we're in the office. And the greens, the reds, the blue and orange, the color is almost violent, and it is really beautiful. It pops. But anyway, so we're in the study now, and these two stuffy old guys are discussing attempts by Thorkell to recruit them by mail for research at his remote institute in the Amazon. I think it's supposed to be in Peru. And this is Dr. Bullfinch we're meeting. He's one of these two guys here. And they're discussing the pros and cons of joining Dr. Thorkell's Jungle Institute. Pros are that he is the greatest living biologist, so be good to work with him. Cons are, he's a strange man, secretive about his experiments. You already get the impression that these guys suspect he may kill them. And I love the strong vibe from the very beginning that this is going to be like the fire festival of scientific research. It's just like lure everybody to a remote location and then just watch it all go to hell.
Yeah. Like it's pretty obvious where this is, at least in general, where this is going. Like, mad scientist is up to bad stuff in the middle of nowhere where there is no law but his own. Let's go hang out with him and see what happens.
Yeah. And then there's a sort of recruiting montage.
These scenes they're brief. There's not much to them.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, hey, if you paid your hotel bill, no. Well, you better join up with us then.
Right. So we get Dr. Bullfinch, and then we get Dr. Mary Robinson, who's writing a letter saying she's joining the team.
I think so the
letter. Yeah. I think the letter says something like, should be no problem or something. And then we see the recruitment of a good-for-nothing deadbeat geologist named Dr. Bill Stockton. This is the guy played by Thomas Coley. And he is pulled in on the promise of having his many IOUs remitted. So when we meet him, he's lounging in a patio recliner. And I don't know if you noticed this. Did you notice that there are just, in at least one of these shots, there are bugs crawling all over his lap?
No, I did not notice that.
I mean, it's easy to miss. It goes by pretty quick, and I don't think it's supposed to be like that. I think it's just something that happened to get caught by the camera. But in one of the shots, there are at least three flies simultaneously. A couple are on his belt buckle. One's kind of to the side of his crotch. And it makes me wonder, like, what, did he spill sugar water on his lap or something in an earlier take?
I don't know. I mean, is he shirtless in the scene?
No. Okay. He's got a shirt on, yeah.
Okay. Well, I was thinking maybe they oiled him up a bit, you know?
Okay.
But who knows, huh?
But yeah, so they're recruiting him because I think there was supposed to be another mineralogist or geologist, and that person fell through. So now they're trying to get the deadbeat guy, but he's a handsome deadbeat. And then finally, they're out in the field in Peru, and Bullfinch, Robinson, and Stockton recruit a miner/mule wrangler named Steve, who has a lot of mule thoughts, and he wants to get rich. And there's a mule haggling scene between Bullfinch and Steve, which is pretty funny. Steve's like, you can't have the mules. I need them for something. And then all these eggheads are like, but Dr. Thor-Kell is the greatest living authority on organic molecular structure. And the mule man is not very impressed. But eventually they get him to go along by promising him riches and saying that he can come with them to make sure the mules are okay.
Yeah, it doesn't make a tremendous amount of sense, but okay, he's coming along.
Right. So they journey through the jungle. They arrive at Dr. Thor-Kell's compound. Thor-Kell's assistant, Pedro, comes to inform him that they've arrived. And when Thor-Kell is interrupted, I just want to say he's wearing an awesome helmet/suit. Rob, I attached a picture I found of the helmet for you to look at here. It's just like a can, just like a straight up thick can with two eye holes surrounded by glass and then a kind of rounded top. It's not very elaborate, but it looks great.
Yeah, it looks kind of, I mean, it reminds me a lot of some of the stock rocket men and robot costumes of the day. Mm-hmm. It looks a little bit like a medieval knight as well.
Oh, it's kind of the knight guarding the bridge in Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so they get there and they all meet Dr. Thor-Kell, and Dr. Thor-Kell is a creep from the first minute. They do not like ease into it. He's got the unholy combo of a huge head with tiny glasses, and he's huge in general, but it's just this like large, bulky, bald man grabbing people by the arm and moving them around and saying like, I'm so glad you've come. He might as well be saying, you know, what lovely cells you're made out of. And we find out that Dr. Thor-Kell sent for the assistance of the other scientists because of damage to his eyes. The damage to his eyes no longer allows him to use the microscope. But I was wondering, wait a minute, then if that's the only problem, why did he send for three different scientists then? It almost seems like the implication is that Dr. Thor-Kell thinks that if he had fully functioning eyes, he would be worth four scientists put together.
Yeah, that makes sense. Or maybe he doesn't expect all of them to live that long, you know?
Right.
He needs multiple sets of spare eyes.
Well, this is weird because, so here's a question I have. He is a creep from the beginning, but the movie does not suggest that he planned to kill them all along. Like, mm-hmm. The fact that he kills them does genuinely seem to be an unexpected development for him. He kills them because they discover his secrets, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's revealed that he sort of needed a mineral specialist to weigh in on some of his work. He needed somebody with a biology background, but I don't know about the professor. Did he? I mean, just sort of brought him in to boast to him about maybe part of it is like ultimately he needs an audience. Like he's doing amazing things. So yes, I need a team of judges to come here and tell me how great I am.
I think we're sort of rewriting the script as we go, but that's, I think you're onto something there. That is part of it. Like he, as a megalomaniac, he needs people to witness his greatness.
Yeah. So that's one of the downsides to working out in the jungle is that in the jungle is you occasionally have to bring people in to recognize your greatness.
Right. And so they're there and they recognize his greatness, but he wants them to get right to work. So he has them look at some stuff in a microscope, and Stockton, the deadbeat hunk, he sees some iron crystals under the microscope. This is like minutes after they've arrived. And he says, yes, it's iron crystals in the microscope. And Dr. Thor-Kell is like, ah, eureka. Okay, that's it. Well, I'm done with you guys now. And Bullfinch, which is funny. I mean, very funny. And Bullfinch is mad. He immediately gets super indignant and starts yelling. He's like, you can't do this to us. At one point, Bullfinch is like, are you intimating that you brought us here just for 5 minutes of work? And Thor-Kell is like, I am not intimating. I am merely stating a fact, that's one of my favorite types of statements in English. The I'm merely stating a fact, like that wasn't a threat. It was a promise. You know, I'm not suggesting anything. I'm merely stating a fact. I wonder when was the first instance of that.
I don't know. But yeah, this seems like at least an early variation on the theme.
But anyway, Bullfinch and Robinson, they are mad, and they want to know what it is that Thork is working on before they leave. Steve, the mule guy, he thinks he knows. He thinks the answer is that there is a mine full of precious ore somewhere around here. Stockton doesn't seem to care much. It seems like he's fine to just like get his bill settled and then leave. All he wants to do is lay around in a chair, basically.
Yeah. But the other two, it is kind of like they thought this was going to be Thorkell et al.
Yes.
You know, they thought they were going to get co-author
credit. Yes, exactly.
But yeah. No, there's only one author on Thorkell research, and that's Dr. Thorkell.
Now, you might know more about this than me. I was kind of curious about this movie's abundance of unflattering pants. There are multiple characters wearing pants that have like big, saggy butt and thigh areas that sometimes make it look like they're wearing like a weird sort of diaper or just have a saggy butt in the pants. Are these some specific kind of rugged outdoor pants of the era, like you know, the go into the jungle pants? I didn't know what the deal with this was.
I don't know. I just thought maybe that was the style of the day. You know, you just wore big balloony pants, but I could be wrong. Maybe the pants experts out there can weigh in.
Well, anyway, Steve, the mule guy, goes out snooping at night the day before Thorkell has told them they're supposed to leave. Thorkell says, you need to leave tomorrow. And so it's that night, and Steve goes out snooping around. I think he wants to track down the mine. So while Thorkell is inside wearing his crazy helmet and doing science work, Steve is snooping around this big hole in the ground that has a giant like rigging over it and with some kind of rope dangling something down in the hole. And then he's almost caught by Thorkell. Thorkell comes out and Baker hides, and it is revealed that Thorkell is operating some kind of awesome giant copper drill in the Thorkell super deep borehole. He's like drilling down into the earth and getting something out of the earth. I don't know. I think maybe it's the radium samples.
Yeah, there's this, they don't talk about it that much, but there's this sense that he's somehow absorbing radiation out of the ground itself. Mm-hmm. You know, by lowering this probe down into it. That's kind of the sense I was getting from it.
Yeah. And then we see at some point Thorkell is alone in his lab later, and it reveals that he has created a tiny pony. This is very much like the Septimus Pretorius images. So there is somehow they've superimposed footage of a full-sized pony kind of neighing and clomping around, but they have matted that onto the shot of Thorkell sitting at a table. And so it looks like the pony is on the table, and it looks great.
Yeah.
But then later we check in, I guess this is the next morning, Bullfinch is examining some pig remains that he came across, and he claims that he's discovered a new species of pig that is only 4 inches long at maturity, and Bullfinch tries to name the species after himself, like you do. And then Thorkell rolls up on them, and he's immediately like, ha ha, you weak-minded fool. You think you've discovered a new pig. And he said, I wrote down this quote, strange how absorbed man has always been in the size of things.
Yes, because of course he knows what this is. This is not a new species of pig. This is just a normal pig that he shrank down.
He's been shrinking pigs for months, and they're all here amazed, thinking they've discovered new species of pigs. And he's like, ha ha, you idiots, you don't understand pig shrinking. I'll tell you about pig shrinking. But Bullfinch retorts, he says that size is the chief difference between mammals. I wrote down this quote as well. He says, in all essentials, a mouse and a whale are identical. So Bullfinch, I guess he's supposed to be like the second best biologist in the world, but I'm not sure about that
one. There was a big gap between first and second greatest biologist of the time, I guess. I think great biologists in real life before these guys would have argued, no, a mouse and a whale are not essentially the same creature. There are some major differences.
But after this, I like this. Thorkell, like we said, even though he is very much a creep from the beginning, he does seem to give them another chance. He tries to send them away again. He's like, be on your way. But Bullfinch is just so mad. He refuses to leave until he finds out what's going on. And then Thorkell begins to threaten them. He's like, if you do not leave within the hour, you will remain at your own peril. So there's some snooping around after this. Thorkell goes back, I guess, assuming that they're going to leave, but they end up investigating. They're too curious for their own good. They hear some horse sounds, and they end up spying on Thorkell appearing to, like, search around for a horse in tall grass. So mm-hmm. they all start to think, okay, Thorkell has gone mad. But Pedro explains that actually he has delivered a bunch of animals to Thorkell and he doesn't know where they are now. He's delivered rats and chickens and dogs and cats and he doesn't know where they are now except for there's this cat, Satanas. Mm-hmm. And oh my God, Satanas is a good cat.
Yeah, upon just mere introduction of Satanas by Dr. Thorkell, I instantly laugh, in part because just seeing a cat just sitting there looking slightly bored in a film is always a delight, mm-hmm. But also because it doesn't take much to realize where this is going. You know, that cat is going to try and eat a tiny person at some point in this film.
Oh, yeah. Which is a brilliant idea for a horror movie, by the way. I mean, a cat of sufficient size to attack you is a terrifying proposition.
Oh, yeah. Like, anybody who owns a cat can attest to this because, you know, sometimes they will hunt the feet of full-sized adults like me. And their speed, their reflexes are terrifying, despite how much time they spend, you know, laying around doing nothing and sleeping. When they want to move, they can do so with just incredible speed. So it's easy to imagine yourself as a small creature and having to face, the ferocity of a domestic cat. You wouldn't stand a chance. Your only chance really would be that it would grow bored and torturing you to death.
Yeah. I mean, I would say seek out water because, you know, a lot of domestic cats don't really like getting too wet. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess there's some exceptions, but, you know, they can be scared about getting too close to water. But then again, if you're very small, I guess water would probably, like a shrunken human might very well be in extreme danger from water. We can talk about this more as we go on, but I recall again the J.B.S. Haldane essay, on being the right size, where he talks about how getting wet is an entirely different proposition for a small animal than it is for a larger animal, because like if a rat gets wet, like a huge percent of its body weight is now clinging to the outside of it.
Yeah.
But anyway, so there's this question, like, where did all the animals go? You know, all the animals that Pedro delivered, and where are they now? Pedro says, I don't know, but Satanas, every day she gets more fat.
She is really living her best life here. She's yeah. getting to hunt and kill so many animals that she wouldn't get to otherwise.
Shrunken pigs, shrunken horses.
Mm-hmm.
It's all gravy for Satanas.
Yeah.
But anyway, so they're packing up to actually leave this time, I think. But then they discover that they keep finding reasons to stay. They discovered that the ore that they've been finding around this place contains radium, which at this time they're like, whoa, that's worth a lot of money. And it's very important for scientific research. I guess this would have been on the cusp of the era of the discovery of nuclear power.
Yeah, so there's certainly, the scientists are like, this is great for science, and then Mule Guy is like, that's some expensive radium. I want a piece of it.
Yes, get me the money. And so they start snooping around in Thorkell's stuff, and then there's a big confrontation. They find records of him saying that he has shrunk things, and they're like, well, he's obviously lost his mind. And then he comes in and discovers them going through his stuff. They have a confrontation, and he's like, here, well, let me explain everything to you. Come into this room and look at my condenser. And so they all go in there, Robinson, Bullfinch, Steve, Stockton, and Pedro.
Yeah, at last he's like, Pedro, get in here, this room.
Yeah,
this room.
Yeah, everybody cram into this room. Don't be suspicious. Just look at the condenser. And then he slams the door on them and shrinks them. And now we've reached the situation of the film. Everybody except Thorkell has been shrunk to about 13 inches tall.
Mother's Day is coming, and Mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get Mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get Mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So instead of getting mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for mom is Mother's Day. Because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for mom at the best price for you. Artesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a Gagillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
And so after this, they're trapped in a room having been shrunk, and Thorkell is like doing some playful diagnostics, saying like, wow, your vocal cords still work, and you're of this size, and he's crowing over his victory over them, while the rest of the main characters scamper around on the floor trying to hide and escape. And here's where the special effects just get wonderful, because a lot of what you have here are fully built sets to make actors at normal size appear to be like, somewhere between like 6 and 13 inches tall, according to perspective. So they're like giant chairs, and they'll go up to one of the legs of the chair and crouch behind it, and giant books and things like that.
Yeah, I love it when films would do this, and I guess they still do variations on this, but I talked to a guy once in real life, who had previously worked in special effects, and he had worked on the film Stephen King's Cat's Eye, which you might remember doesn't have any miniaturization occurring, but it does have a troll creature, which was, of course, played by like an adult in a full-size costume. And in order to make him seem like a tiny creature, they had to build like an enormous child's bed for this actor to prance around on. So I got to see some behind-the-scenes photos of that. He had in an album, and it was super cool.
I love it. I love it. I really, really miss the era of special effects through built sets and built environments. I do feel like something really is lost. No matter how good an animated environment can look, I mean, the green screen world, I do feel like has lost something beautiful.
Mm. Yeah, there's a craftsmanship to it. I mean, not to say there's not a craftsmanship in creating virtual environments, but there's a, you know, a physical craft to it that perhaps is kind of lost.
You know, one thing I noticed at the very beginning is that as soon as we come on the new characters, I guess they are too small for their original clothes now. So instead, the characters have all replaced their original clothes with like togas. They're like little torn pieces of cloth that they're wearing, like togas and stuff. And this really, I think, heightens the connection to the Odyssey.
That's right. And of course, the film will continue to, it will let you know that it is referencing the Odyssey. Right. It's going to be very direct about it. But yeah, this may be the first sign that they're going in that direction. So yeah, I love this because their clothes were not shrunk. Right. Dr. Thorkell is picking up their clothes and putting them in a bag later. But I guess he left either pristine handkerchiefs in there and some sewing equipment at scale for them, or he had pre-arranged clothing made from handkerchiefs for them, one or the other, because they seem to fit rather well.
Yeah. And so Thorkell says that, you know, he's like, well, I've been working for days without rest, and now I'm going to fall asleep. So he falls asleep. And while he's asleep, they escape the room by building a tower out of books and using a matchstick to draw back the bolt on the door. And then there's a great moment I loved where they're trying to sneak around outside once they've gotten out. And there are some chickens, just like
yep.
giant chickens. And giant chickens, hey, that would be really scary. I mean, that's like a dinosaur.
Yeah, I would be terrified. Yes, like a big feathered T-Rex, and
yeah.
You know, I guess with any of these animals, you have to ask yourself, what is the threshold of miniaturization at which I am identified as potential prey by this animal?
Right.
You
know? And the chickens never try to eat them, but the implication is there. I mean, I really do. Yeah. So if you were 13 inches tall and you were walking past a chicken, I mean, that'd probably be like a human walking past a Deinonychus or something, like theropod dinosaur, the predatory one.
Yeah, if it decided you were worth a peck, I mean, that would be death.
But they do a thing that really did make me laugh. They do the just act natural walk while they walk past the chickens, you know, mm-hmm. like pretend like we're supposed to be here. And then they get attacked by Satanas, the cat, and they have to hide among a bunch of cactus, which I thought was a cool idea.
Yeah, yeah.
And Pedro's dog, Tipo, eventually comes to the rescue, chases off Satanas. And here we get the movie, I guess, offering thoughts about how you would be treated differently if you were miniaturized by a cat versus by a dog.
Yeah, this was fun because I've heard this many times before, people commenting that, okay, if you were to suddenly be, you know, an inch tall or whatever, your dog would still be your friend, but your cat would just eat you immediately. And I don't disagree with that principle, though I do, if I'm going to seriously consider the question, I'm going to wonder if a dog would be able to recognize you by sight or by smell in a miniaturized form, like if you start asking hard scientific questions about all of this.
Yeah, I don't know. I am a dog lover, but I kind of think the dog would eat you.
Yeah?
Yeah. Mm.
We're more inclined to believe and want to believe the dog would be like, oh, master, why are you so small? Let me help you. Whereas there's no doubt with the cat. Like the cat would be like, sorry, the table has turned and you know what I have to do.
The cat would 100% eat you. I feel like I'm at about 80% and the dog would eat you.
Yeah. In a way, it's like that slight level of uncertainty, that makes it more terrifying. Like if you were suddenly miniaturized in your home, you'd be like, oh, crap, I got to avoid the cat at all costs because that is death. But then you're like, I don't know about the dog. The dog could be my savior, but the dog might just eat me anyway, or at least put me in his mouth for a while.
Yeah, yeah. So after this, we get a little interlude where we see the humans sort of adapting to their new scale, and it sort of turns into one of those recapitulation of the discovery of technology narratives. Like you get in stories like the Swiss Family Robinson. I think that's really part of the pleasure people get in a lot of Castaway stories is yep. they really like that, like watching people rebuild technological capability out of the materials available to them.
Yeah, like Robinson Crusoe or to a certain extent, Flight of the Phoenix was like that. I think they remade it at some point, but the original was like a, God, what was it? A B, not a B-24. It was a B, Oh, it was a B-29, of course. B-29 crashes in the desert, and then they have to take it apart and try and build a new airplane out of this four-prop engine airplane and then fly out of the desert in it.
Yeah, so obviously the fact that this type of narrative recurs so much, I mean, I do think it's clear that like some people really enjoy watching this sort of thing happen. Mm-hmm. It's some kind of fantasy fulfillment. And this movie has stuff kind of like this, except instead of a desert island where you're trying to recreate known technology and solutions and stuff out of, I don't know, coconuts or whatever, instead it's on a tiny scale. So you see them figuring out how to use a needle as a giant drill or a scissor handle as a sword and stuff like that.
Oh man, you know, I have to jump back in and say I'm mistaken. It was not a B-29 in Flight of the Phoenix. It was a C-82. But I think I'm confusing it with some Disney film that came out where the characters did a similar thing and turned a B-29 into a sailing vessel of some sort. But at any rate, it's a trope. It's a fun thing that you see in a lot of films.
Is that Waterworld?
They might have had one of these in Waterworld, but it was a different film that I don't think I ever saw, but I vaguely remember the VHS box for it.
Wait, it's the version of Noah's Ark made with John Voight. I'm pretty sure that had some aircraft in it.
Actually, I've looked it up, Joe, and it is the last flight of Noah's Ark from 1980. It starred Elliot Gould and a B-29.
The last flight of Noah's Ark? You're not kidding?
I'm not kidding. That was the name. It was a Disney film. I don't think this one has been added to Disney Plus yet.
I was joking. The John Voight Noah's Ark does have pirates in it, but I don't recall aircraft.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, back to miniaturized people. They're making tools. They're rediscovering what they can use for a weapon, et cetera. They're making new clothes, all while Dr. Thorkell is snoozing off his latest science bender.
Yeah, and when he does wake up from the science bender, he has got a bit of a science hangover. He's kind of frisky, but he's also kind of mad, and he's like, "What is he going to do with these shrunken people?" And Dr. Bullfinch starts. He's still just like mouthing off to Thorkell. Yeah. he's like, "We are prisoners in Cyclops' cave." Again, recalling the story from the Odyssey where Ulysses, or he calls him Ulysses in the movie. Ulysses, maybe better known today as Odysseus. And his crew are captured within the cave of Polyphemus, the Cyclops on some island, and they have to find a way to escape, and they end up blinding the Cyclops by stabbing him in the eye. But Odysseus has said that his name is No One, so when somebody comes to ask if the Cyclops needs help, the Cyclops says, "No one is hurting me." Very clever.
Yes.
But Dr. Thorkell ends up catching Bullfinch in a net. Oh, after a part where Bullfinch tells off a chicken, he's like, "Go away, you ridiculous fowl." And Bullfinch, as always, is extremely uncooperative. Thorkell is like, he brings him inside to measure him in various ways. And then Thorkell expresses disappointment. This is privately just between him and Bullfinch. All the other people are still outside. He says, "You know what? Your bodies are growing. Your bodies are reacting as if you have reverted to childhood, and you will eventually grow back to regular size." And Thorkell, of course, can't allow this, because then they would interfere with his work again. So Thorkell turns to murder once again. We've seen him murder to solve a problem at the beginning of the movie, and his eyes become cold, and he's like, "I'm going to do it again." And he gets a cotton swab and puts it in some kind of chemical and smothers Dr. Bullfinch with it and kills him. And there's like a giant fake hand for Bullfinch to be held in. It's pretty good.
It's a great scene. And again, very brutal. Despite the sanitized nature of this film as a whole, it's just a cold murder of this professor. But also during this scene, I was thinking about what Dr. Thorkell said about how you're going to grow as if you were children into adult form again, which in this movie, all it means is you're going to get big again by the end of the film. And and it's saying, like, if you had hidden, you would have just returned to normal anyway. But instead, you came back to me and now I will kill you. But I had a moment there where I was imagining, like, what does this mean? Because a baby is not like a miniature adult.
Right.
You know, it changes a lot as it becomes a grown person. So I was trying to just contemplate, like, what would that mean if you were a miniaturized person and then you grew, like, what monstrous full-sized forms would they grow into?
Are you going to have skull plates fusing together again? Like, what's going on?
Like, so that was kind of a nightmare scenario that this film does not explore. But I had a moment there where I was like, oh, my God.
Dr. Bullfinch, say hello to a second round of baby teeth.
I refuse.
And then, so we mentioned that scene is kind of brutal. There's another, there's a lot of this is not a bloody film, but there's a lot of implied violence in it that is very brutal in its suggestion. So you see the other humans after Bullfinch is murdered, they're hiding in this big thicket of cactus, and then Thorkell comes out, and I guess he's trying to kill them, and he starts chopping up the cactus with a shovel. It's messed up, but but we find when he chops it all up and then finds they've escaped through a hole in the wall out into the jungle, and Thorkell taunts them over the wall, saying that they will never live half an hour out in the jungle. And sure enough, there comes along a storm, which, again, think about how terrifying of a threat a storm would be if you were tiny, if you were like, you know, 6 inches tall or a foot tall or whatever this is.
Yeah, I mean, just on top of the jungle itself, like when Thorkell said that, I was like, no, he's absolutely right. Like, to go into the jungle at this size is just death. Like, everything is going to potentially eat you.
Yeah.
But then on top of that, the storm.
Right. And again, this comes back to the Haldane essay I mentioned earlier on being the right size. The thing about how when you have a much larger surface area to mass ratio, as smaller creatures do, there are advantages to that. Like, you can fall off of a roof and probably not be hurt because, you know, the amount of air resistance provided by the surface of your body will be enough to keep you going pretty slow, actually, as you fall compared to the mass in your body. But the downsides are, like, getting wet is a terrifying proposition when you are tiny. Like, the surface tension of water clings to you like a kind of slime. And so imagine, you're out in the jungle and the rain is coming down and there's rivulets everywhere. It's very scary. So they end up coming across a boat in a river later on, and they try to use technology to free it, and they get attacked by a crocodilian. I think it's a crocodile, might have been an alligator. I didn't check the nose shape too well. But the crocodile attack sequence is great. They're trying to fend it off with fire, but they've got these like little tiny sticks that are on fire that are just not enough fire.
Yeah, they're just kind of dropping it on the creature, and it doesn't seem to particularly care.
Yeah, and then eventually after they chase it off by throwing a bunch of flaming sticks on it, Thorkell returns. He comes and finds them, and again, it's brutal. Pedro heroically leads his dog away from them, drawing off the smell, and so he saves the rest of the people, but Thorkell sees him and shoots him, and so Pedro has been murdered. And then after that, the rest of the people are hiding in some grass, and Thorkell starts stomping through the grass, and then when he can't find them, he burns the grass.
Yeah, so there's this inferno that he starts here, just trying to flush them out.
Yeah.
But it doesn't quite work because they find another place that they can hide themselves.
Right. They stow away in his specimen box, the box that he was going to put them in when he found them. Mm-hmm. And so Robinson, Stockton, and Steve, the mule guy, are the three people left alive, and they ride back in this box to Thorkell's hut. And once they get there, they get out, and Stockton decides, no, I'm going to stand my ground this time. I'm not going to try to escape. We've got to kill Thorkell. And the other two agree. So first they try to aim a shotgun like a cannon at his pillow in his bed, but then Thorkell doesn't go to bed. Instead, he falls asleep in his chair. And then it really gets into the blinding of Polyphemus in the Odyssey because they steal his glasses. Remember, it said at the beginning that he called them there because his eyes were so damaged he really couldn't see without his glasses. And they know where he keeps his extra pairs of glasses because they find them when they're going through his stuff earlier, and they hide those.
Yeah, they stick him through like a hole in the floor or the wall. So now he has the only the one pair, and they remove those as well. So yeah, suddenly you have this this blinded Polyphemus trope going on here.
Yeah, and so Thorkell is enraged. He's smashing, you know, he's running around trying to destroy them. He does recover one pair of glasses, but one of the lenses is smashed, and he says, "Now you can call me Cyclops because I have one good eye."
Thank you for being clear about the title of the film, Dr. Thorkell.
I think they could have done without that.
Yeah.
But so there's a final confrontation. In the end, I won't spoil exactly how it happens, but they are victorious. They end up defeating Dr. Cyclops here. And in the end, the three remaining characters, they regrow to full size and they travel back to civilization. And the main things now we find are that Stockton and Robinson are now in love, because of course, and we find that Steve, the mule guy, does not like cats. He sees a cat back in the town they go to, and he's like, scram.
Well, maybe you remember this. I watched it last week, and I think you watched it this morning. Did we ever get any real payoff with Satanas?
No.
Like
no.
It's not like they had a big throwdown with they didn't have a big fight with the cat. They didn't have to, like, slay the cat. Or I think the dog just chased Satanas off, and that was it.
Yeah. I'm glad they didn't have to kill the cat, because, I mean, the cat's just being a cat.
It's true. Yeah. I mean, but I also wonder, like, was that, like, maybe something they wanted to do, but they just didn't have the effects. Like, maybe that was just too much of an effects ask to have, like, a big fight with a giant cat. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Because, there were films that would later go more in that direction of having, the cat to aggressively go after tiny humans.
Well, like Cat's Eye, the one you mentioned.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, not a tiny human, an evil troll. And the cat there is the hero going against the evil tiny monster.
So, yeah, this is absolutely a fun film. There's not a tremendous amount of depth to it. There's not a huge amount of monster science to discuss about it. I mean, you can take various things. You can certainly get really pedantic on the idea of miniaturizing organisms, and then how does that miniaturized organism react and fit in with an immediate environment that it was not miniaturized. And depending on how small you go, those problems can be, can be quite extreme. But then there are other directions as well. We found this interesting paper that we were both looking at titled Human Engineering and Climate Change by Lau, Sandberg, and Roche. This was from 2012, published in Ethics, Policy, and Environment. And it's a pretty wild read. You can find it for free online. I think we found it at blc.arizona.edu. And one of the things they get into is, like, if you were to shrink humans down, they would have less of an environmental footprint. So it would ultimately be better for the environment.
This paper is this is something Dr. Thorkell would write. I started reading it and I was just like, what? It is interesting, but it is nuts. and I don't know. I mean, it seems like there may be more direct things that could be done about climate change than saying, like, hey, what if we were to shrink humans so that they consume fewer resources?
Yeah. There are other levers we should pull first, certainly. We shouldn't take the Thorkell path, the Thorkell way on that particular problem.
I mean, it's at least got to go like solar panels before shrinking people.
Absolutely. All right. Well, you may be wondering, where can I watch Dr. Cyclops? Well, these things are always subject to change, but we actually had a hard time tracking this one down. We couldn't find it streaming anywhere or for digital purchase or rental. We couldn't find a physical rental either. So we actually bought it on special edition Blu-ray from KL Studio Classics, a.k.a. Kino Lorber. It's a brand new 4K master. It also has an audio commentary by film historian Richard Harlan Smith. I didn't have a chance to listen to it, but it sounds like it would be pretty cool. The box art on this one is great. Unlike some of the other previous releases that have come out that had kind of like cheesy box art, like this one has that that weird probe mechanism in the center that is lowered into the earth. You have a picture of Dr. Thorkell there with it looks like lasers coming out of his eyes. It's pretty good.
Yeah, it's really good art.
But then again, this is also a classic film by a notable director, so it's entirely possible you might be able to catch this one on Turner Classic Movies or something to that effect. I know we heard from some people after we did our episode on Mad Love, chiming in and saying, "Oh, they're showing Mad Love tonight." So who knows? Maybe check your local listings is what I'm saying. Well, let's do it then. Let's go ahead and call it done. We're done with Dr. Cyclops here, but this was a fun one to watch, a fun one to discuss. And if you would like to listen to us discuss other films, you can catch other episodes of Weird House Cinema every Friday in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed. So our core episodes are about science and culture, and those publish on Tuesdays and Thursdays. We do an artifact episode on Wednesdays, listener mail on Mondays. But Friday, that's when we get to cut loose and discuss some sort of a weird cinematic gem, generally from yesteryear.
That's right, so keep tuning in. Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us to let us know feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.